rephrase what Aaron was saying. We are basically just talking about... Sorry, Aaron, would you mind just rephrasing what you were talking about there?
Yeah, so essentially my critique or my criticism is that there are some situations where you don't have a golden mean between what is good for you and what is necessarily good for others.
Yeah.
So when you end up in that type of social situation, it seems like you have to choose between virtue ethics and absolute prohibition. You have to choose whether or not doing what is best for you in a certain situation and doing what is necessarily good for a group at some personal cost, like those types of self-sacrifice situations, I think might be a gray area for this ethical system.
Now I want to pass it to Tegan to give your thoughts, and then I'll give some more critiques of my own.
Great, thanks. What I've been thinking about was a couple things. Aaron brought up the cult of Pythagoras, and it's important in noting in Pythagoreanism that there were two different schools of Pythagoreanism. One that, yes, focused on mathematics and finding, understanding the universe through number, finding the number of the universe, and one that focused more on his personal teachings, that was more of a religious sense of thing. We see this division that we were talking about possibly happening earlier, that although there were two groups of people who were united under the pursuit of understanding this figure, this person they admired to be like, there was a hyperfixation on one quality of that person that they both split off and pursued. I'll be honest and say I'm more of a Platonist than Aristotelian in my scholarship. I think it's important to look at that in the philosophical historical context for a minute and suggest that in the Republic, when we are dealing with what is justice, Socrates goes around and he has many discussions about this. And one definition he comes to is doing one's own work is the best translation. What does that mean? It means that Socrates thought that there was skills that we were naturally adept to perform, and that we should seek out those skills and to do them excellently. And this was in contrast to the Greek term of practicing what is known in the Greek term as pleonexia, desiring more than is necessary. And so I think when we look to the Aristotelian, can't speak today, concept of virtue ethics, the pursuit of virtue is, and I appreciate what Mihai had to say earlier in his thoughts, and also the scholar we are taking influence from, that the pursuit of virtue is much more than just a legal framework. It is, as I've stated and my colleagues have also stated, it's a desire to understand what virtue itself looks like. And I think that it is, I think it's a interesting thing. The absolute prohibition, right, is saying, as I stated earlier, here's the line. Here's where we do not go. Because I think if Socrates were to look at that, he would say, I see a bit of myself there, in the sense that there is for every person a skill they are naturally suited towards. Some are philosophers, some are accountants, some are grocery store clerks, right? Some are better at certain things, but the the pursuit of virtue is something that we all need in order to understand that, I think. And so talking about observing patterns, the ability for someone who sees virtue to observe patterns through observation, Socrates definitely would say, yeah, that's true, but you need to make sure that your observation group are people who are suited towards that, right? And so, yeah, go ahead, Mihai.
Yeah, no, interesting. I think that's an interesting way of framing it. And this brings me to one of my main critiques of this particular theory, which is that as a whole, virtue ethics, to me, though attractive in the sense that it would be nice to live in a world of virtuous actors, it'd be nice to know how to teach each other how to be virtuous. The problem to me is that there are some epistemological gaps that even modern virtue theorists have not been able to cross yet, and that weakens the theory to me. So what I mean by that is that there are, by epistemological gaps, I mean there are places in which we don't seem to know exactly what we're talking about, definitions-wise and categories-wise, and that creates some problems. So first of all, the typical, what's a virtuous action, what's a virtuous characteristic, who is a virtuous person? These are things that we should be able to answer, and of course different people answer them differently. But also, in this particular context, you know, what is a human condition? What defines a human condition that is appropriate for judging virtue, and what is one where, for example, people are being forced to do things that are not virtuous, but maybe patterns are still identifiable? Or, for example, he differentiates between three strengths of Aristotelian prohibitions. He says strong Aristotelian prohibitions will hold across all human social contexts. Moderate ones will hold across proximate human social contexts, as in the ones that are expected to remain consistent for a good amount of time into the future, but may change eventually. And weak Aristotelian prohibitions will hold across a specified subset of human social contexts, like they will hold for lawyers, or they'll hold for doctors, or they'll hold relative to one particular scenario. And I think the problem for me with this kind of distinction is that all of a sudden you're divvying things up into so many subcategories just to be able to capture all of the variety that exists within human social contexts. And I think that's a weakness to the theory in general, that if we can't define what adultery is, and we can't define a specified list of virtuous characteristics, and all of a sudden all these virtuous characteristics and prohibitions change depending on what job you have, like Tegan was saying, depending on what you're apt to be virtuous in, it seems to me there's just gaps there where it's like, oh, if we could explain all of this, this would work, but give me the explanation first and then we'll talk, you know? That's kind of where my mind is going on that.
One thing that's very difficult here is to think about what is the role of the ethicist for this thinker in society. Because if rules are not enough, because essentially you could argue that the main role of ethicists in the modern day is to, you know, explore new avenues of thought and to kind of construct, you know, modes of thinking and guidelines for those areas. So for instance, there was a recent news article I read that Microsoft had fired a group of ethicists that were related to one of their AI programs. And so there was some controversy over this because there is, in the emergency realm of artificial intelligence, there is a strong believed need for ethical practices and for people to have jobs to create these practices to mitigate against dangerous and negative outcomes. And often it seems like the way that we do this is by creating rules and creating guidelines for other people who are not skilled in ethical matters. So if ethics is truly a skill, but rule following is not enough to say that you're a good person, then it leaves society itself in kind of a haphazard position, because
yeah, chicken and the egg, right?
How are the rest of us supposed to function if we don't have a high level of ethical skill, if rules are not enough? It leaves all of society kind of very dependent on people who are ethically minded to essentially keep us in line or help us through things.
And this goes into my second critique as well. One second here. I just want to mention this and we'll circle back. This goes into my second critique as well, because it struck me as I was listening to this, especially when he was talking about how Kantian prohibitions, I mentioned this in the first half, agents are aware and intentionally avoid the prohibitions because they violate, you know, the sort of rational law. Aristotelian virtuous agent needn't know. This is a quote from the lecture notes. Aristotelian virtuous agent needn't know that some course of action is something virtuous agents would never do. The person is just trying to work out the best way for them to act in their situation. But if we nerds, as it says in the notes, if he means philosophers, ethicists, whatever, pay attention, we might spot patterns. So Aristotelian prohibitions are discoveries of philosophers and psychologists. We get into what you were saying, Aaron, this chicken and the egg. So, like, how do we learn to act virtuously in the first place? Or if there are people that are virtuous, because we can all just agree, yeah, that's a good person over there, whose job is it to identify what's good about them? And then where does that leave intention, right? Because the whole point of virtue theory is that you need to know what you're doing and feel the right way about doing it. Well, if you're going about blindly, kind of like, oh, people told me I'm a good person, so I'm just going to keep acting how I think is right, like, where's the intention that we're following the virtuous path, right?
Right.
Tegan, I'll pass it to you there.
Well, I think it's an interesting situation, because the pursuit of virtue, I think for Aristotle, is something that every person should pursue. It's also fair to say, however, that pursuit is more difficult for some than others, for the very, very factors we've described. Realm of influence, networks that, you know, the communities were surrounded by. I think the way that the early philosophers would answer that is to say that in a lot of ways, a lot of virtue ethics is naturally known. I'm going to suggest something that unfortunately we don't have a lot of time to get into, but it's maybe I'll do a follow-up show, you know, and in fact I'll do that. It is to have a discussion upon whether Socrates' ideas of the forms was just then internalized by Aristotle to create the categories of which his ethics are derived. So it is a difficult thing. I think it's important for us now to start to observe, how do we act in the world? And this is my more existential perspective popping out here in terms of phenomenon, that as Mihai has stated, ethics is a practice. So what does it mean to practice ethics? It means to be in dialogue with others of like minds and different experiences, to take these abstract concepts of right and wrong and to say, in all my experience, in all my dialogue, in working with this phenomenon, these ideas, I synthesize that and create this conclusion. There's a lot to be said, but I'm going to let Mihai take it back and lead us towards the finish line.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be an interesting discussion to have. Please do host an episode on that, and I'd love to get into it. So, allow me to summarize a little bit what we've talked about so far, maybe provide another element of defense on the part of Jeremy Reed, and then we'll have some finishing thoughts. So we've been discussing Aristotelian prohibitions, right? The idea that there are some things that virtuous agents never do. They are not absolute prohibitions in the sense of Kant, as in you find them by logic alone and they apply to every rational being that's ever existed or ever will exist. Nor is it like Finnis and other philosophers where it's a matter of Christian theology, sort of there are laws of nature, of religion, of God, that we do not follow, that we do not break. And even if they seem to be producing a bad outcome in the world, it's not our job to distinguish that. It's just we follow it because it's going to lead to the right, you know, sort of kingdom of ends. So it's not those situations, but rather it's a situation in which virtuous agents, there are some things that virtuous agents simply would never do. There's a few ways to define that. One strategy is to say that some actions are just impossible to do correctly. They are analytically vicious, something like adultery. You can never cheat in the right way with the right person at the right time. That's one strategy, though we've talked about some critiques to that. There's the definition that goes like securing human goods. So, for example, there are some things that we want to secure that we can only secure our happiness and our flourishing if we follow certain rules, or they are better secured if we follow certain rules. And lastly, the strategy that Jeremy highlighted is the idea that Aristotelian prohibitions come from virtuous actors, from two questions, essentially. What ends do virtuous and decent people not adopt? And what means do virtuous and experienced people not take? So what are the things that, with a bunch of people that we identify as virtuous, as good people, what are the things that they never do? And the job of the philosopher and the psychologist is to gather all of that data and say, okay, here are the things that virtuous people never do. And we've talked about some critiques to that. We've talked about the epistemological concerns regarding, can we define the terms that we're talking about? Do we know exactly what virtues we're talking about and what crimes we're trying to avoid? I've brought up the idea that, and so has Tegan, that you're kind of disconnecting the actor from intention on this account. Here I'll say that Jeremy did, I actually asked him this question at the lecture, and he replied to me saying that, yes, of course, a person, a virtuous agent, acts according to some thought, some intention. Like when you go to do anything, you're thinking about what is the best thing for me to do here, but they may not notice the pattern of the things that they avoid at all costs. So that's something, you know, we could talk about, but on the whole, I didn't find that convincing. And we talked at the end about a few different strengths, a few different kinds of prohibitions that apply across all, some, or just very specific human contexts. And I brought up the idea that maybe that weakens the theory by suggesting, by it being a little too relative. And in a sense, I didn't feel as if there was a necessary connection established between rules and virtue ethics. Not that there needs to be, it could just be that it's helpful, but I found the connection weak in some respect. And at the end of the day, I think Jeremy suggested that we are just, what we care about is deliberation in our particular social contexts, and that these rules can be helpful because they're just absolute enough so far as they're authoritative in determining what I shouldn't do and have no exceptions. That was his last sort of note on the slide there, on the lecture notes. Ethics is about action, and practically absolute is the right kind of absolute for this context, as long as they're absolute enough. So that's sort of a summary and arc of where we've taken it so far. I'll turn it to you folks to sort of give your closing thoughts on this.
To give a bit of a defense, because I've been a little harsh on these ideas, I do think it would be very difficult to take the position that you should not have any prohibitions in a society, or if a society would be ethical if you removed the mechanisms that the thinker Jeremy Reed was discussing. So looking at virtuous people, essentially learning from example, the secondary claim of following rules. So I think in as much as it's a very difficult question to ask, is this system sufficient in itself to create a ethical person or an ethical society? It's also a different question to say, well, could I make an ethical system without these qualities? And I think it would be very difficult to do that. I think that we need learning by example. We need prohibitions and hard guidelines, rules in society. And we also do need to view things within context. So I do think he provides a valuable tool to the thinkers and the ethicists toolkit. And I think he's also willing to admit that that tool might not be sufficient all the time. So I think, I'm backpedaling a little bit because I've been critiquing this basically for the whole episode, but I think it's also important to recognize there are aspects here, even if you don't agree necessarily with this position, that we definitely need as ethicists. So there are definitely some kernels of truth here that he's going in the right direction, even if we can't get behind the exact position.
I think what the spirit of what Jeremy has to say is true. I think there's a lot of value there. I struggle to. I think the biggest thing is that we come to those. If I was to try and rephrase it slightly, I think the difference between rules, kind of rule enforcement, and what we've been discussing, is that there's a difference between something being arbitrarily decided and through experience determined to be, okay, that's the wrong thing. And a lot of how we determine what the wrong thing is, it is how, not even just in a cultural context, but in a relational context. And to say, for example, why we don't over embellish stories, because sometimes that can hurt people. Having a misrepresentation, no matter what the intent, it can be harmful. And so being kind of embracing Cartesian skepticism a little bit to say, if I wait, I will never be wrong. But we can't live and function in society that way. So right, this is what Jeremy seems to suggest, is that we must determine where the lines are, so that those people who are growing up perhaps without mentorship and philosophical investment know what that is. And that I think was the Platonic vision of the ideal city, was that there would be a group of people. That's the Glauconian version. More specifically, Glaucon city employs a hierarchical structure to say philosophers have a unique ability to observe that pattern. And I think there's a lot more that could be said. But I think one of the topics that I would be interested in picking up at a later date is, how do you empower the individual to notice those patterns? How do you foster in them that skill? Because not all of us are going to become professional ethicists in life.
Perhaps what one of the things Jeremy Reed starts off with there is that it's not enough just to follow rules. Like, we have to aim for a virtue, or like, you know, the reasoning or the heart or the spirit behind the rules. We have to understand that and interact with that if we want to be a virtuous person. We can't just rely on the rule to carry our virtue for us. And I think that's kind of the, I don't know, would you say that's fair, Mihai?
Yeah, I would say that's probably a generous interpretation, not overly generous either, of what he's trying to say. Just the way I approach philosophical questions and ethical questions, the analytical concerns tend to overshadow a little bit for me the acceptance of the theory, in the sense that, and until we can be more specific with regards to the epistemological gaps that I mentioned, I'm going to have more trouble accepting the ideas, regardless of how pretty they might sound. That being said, I appreciate taking what you were saying about empowering the individual to learn virtue and to understand the rules and all of that. I think that's definitely not wrong to say that Jeremy would have that goal, would appreciate that goal. And I think it's a matter of determining, is virtue ethics the tool that's going to get individuals the closest? And that's a discussion for another episode. I don't know if I agree with that, but I appreciate both the critiques and the support that you've given to the theory, because I think that it, you know, it warrants both. And I think we got some really good discussion out of that. That you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kavasser, back behind the mic again to host an episode with Tegan Marshall and Aaron Wang on Aristotelian prohibitions as presented at the University of British Columbia by Jeremy Reed. I think in future episodes, we have some good discussions to be had about, again, empowering the individual in ethical decision making. And Tegan, you mentioned your episode that you decided that you want to do around Socrates and the Socratic forms and the connection that they may, that this may have as a sort of follow-up. So I'm very excited to hear where all of this goes. I want to thank you both once again for coming on the show. And without further ado, wish our audience a good evening or good night, or good morning, wherever they are, and to join us next time.
Recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/the Canadian Philosophy Show and tcps.podbean.com.